A Tempo is a production of the Classical Network and is made possible by the support of listeners like you. Thank you for your support.
Welcome to A Tempo, the Classical Network spotlight on the arts and culture. I'm Rachel Katz, and I'm your host as we explore the changes at work in the performing arts. Each week, I'll bring you some of the latest news and also take time to examine many of the issues that are challenging these arts organizations. We'll look at the impact of the economy, technology, and society on the arts, the importance of arts education, and how these organizations and ensembles are adjusting and innovating as they face the future. Today, we'll take a look at the way COVID-19 has threatened the livelihood of dancers and dance organizations, and how the New York dance community hopes to address a range of issues from pay equity to diversity and inclusion. My guest will be Alejandra Duque Cifuentes, Executive Director of Dance NYC. Let's start out this week with a look at some of the news from around the world of the performing arts. Opera Philadelphia this past week announced that instead of its originally announced O20 Festival, it will launch an online digital channel featuring productions created specifically for the screen. The Opera Philadelphia channel will include new presentations of David T. Little's Soldier Songs and Hans Werner Henze's El Cimarron, new digital operatic premieres, and performances by artistic advisor Lawrence Brownlee, including Cycles of My Being, a song cycle by composer Tyshawn Sorey and lyricist Terrence Hayes that reflects on the experiences of being a Black man in America. The channel will begin offering performances in October and continue through the spring. Although some of its originally scheduled productions have been postponed to later seasons, Opera Philadelphia plans to stage Puccini's Tosca as planned next May. The New York Philharmonic has announced a 30-day practice challenge to promote connections between musicians shut in through the COVID-19 pandemic and raise awareness of the importance of music education. Practice 30 launched today, August 1st, and features videos on YouTube, Instagram, and Facebook by Philharmonic musicians and other artists, including violinist Jennifer Coe, composer Eric Whitaker, the Canadian Brass, people player Wu Man, and R&B artist, composer, and pianist Devante Hines, a.k.a. Blood Orange. The Philharmonic has invited musicians who participate to post videos of them playing some of the challenges on social media using the hashtag Practice30. Those are just some of the headlines this week from around the arts world. The social isolation and economic hardships created by the COVID-19 coronavirus has been extremely harsh on the performing arts, which rely on both the ability of artists to come together and on the presence of live audiences. For dancers, who are often more likely to be independent artists and whose art almost always involves direct interaction, the loss has been acute. Early on in the crisis, Dance NYC, which works with the city's dancers and dance organizations to support and promote dance, recognized the need to advocate for the important role dance plays in the broader community and ensure that dancers are recognized as essential to the benefit of the community. In May, it launched a series of weekly panel discussions on Facebook entitled Artists Are Necessary Workers that has examined the future of dance in a post-pandemic world, including dancer safety, pay equity, and the future of touring and festivals. The series wraps up this Tuesday with a discussion entitled Dance as Dignified Labor. Alejandra Duque Cifuentes is Dance NYC's executive director, and we spoke recently about these challenges and the organization's advocacy efforts.
Dance is a work of the body, and it's a work that happens in time and space with people. Of all of the art forms, it is one of the most ephemeral in that it's experienced and then it disappears. So the inability to share time and space with others has quite literally and figuratively halted the work that dance artists are typically used to doing together and that dance workers are typically used to doing together. And so the needs have been very high. First, in the most obvious way, it's an industry that is highly dependent on earned income. And that earned income, again, comes through moments of gathering. And so it's deeply rattled the financial infrastructure of many of the different dance companies and independent and individual artists as well, particularly because a lot of the dance work that occurs isn't just what we see on the stage. In many ways, what we see on the stage is but the tip of the iceberg. But really, what happens before we arrive to the stage is where the bulk of our ecosystem is manifesting at all times, whether it's in the public school classroom, whether it's in the rehearsal studio, whether it's through writing and the inquiry and scholarship and the history of the work. The majority of it actually occurs before. And so all of the different parts of our ecosystem were impacted when schools also closed, when classes that occurred in the local studio also closed. And so dance, really, of all of the performing arts genres or forms, rather, is one of the least unionized in the United States specifically. And so we are a very nimble workforce that also is lacking a lot of protections around their labor, and therefore there aren't a lot of standardizations around wage and benefits. And so our field has been rattled deeply because not only have we lost the ability to earn income, which typically goes to paying artists, to paying workers, to keeping the lights on, but also the individual artist that isn't always working in one individual company, but rather living in this kind of freelance model, has also lost the ability to have any kind of structure and protection, and are struggling financially as a result.
And I imagine also in terms of even on the practicing side, that's been turned totally upside down, just in terms of the absence of the usual structures, but also, again, being totally by yourself. How have dancers dealt with that aspect?
A combination of ways. I mean, when you have a workforce that's used to moving 6 to 8 hours a day, every day, or potentially multiple days out of the week, going from being in spaces where they can travel across the room to a New York City apartment, for example, in the case of New York City-based artists, where they might have the proper flooring, where they might share space and very likely share space with many other folks. It means that there's been a very real impact to their physical well-being as well as their mental health. We know that movement also is an important component of mental health, whether you're doing it as a professional dancer or not. And so the halting of activity has taken a real toll. It also presents the opportunity for injury to occur. And that injury occurs in two ways, either from suddenly not having access to regular training and then attempting to then move into activity again without having that sustained bodily support, or from trying to do things at home in spaces where the infrastructure doesn't lend itself for it. So, for example, if you're a ballet dancer, or if you're a tap dancer, or if you are used to doing, for example, street dance forms that require a bit more space for turns and things of that nature, when you are trying to do that in your apartment, and maybe you only have a 20 square foot area in your kitchen, you might experience injury because you don't have all of the tools that allow that continued training to happen. We know that a lot of folks have continued to connect through digital classes and have continued rehearsing in as much as is possible. But again, a lot of the work that happens in our community is not necessarily solo or duet based. And so unless dancers were already living together because maybe they were roommates or couples or partners, it really has changed the dynamic of what training looks like when you're not in the room able to be in relationship with other bodies in space. And so that has actually impacted the physical well-being, the mental health of the sector. And as we begin to slowly reopen and different members of the community are considering new ways of doing work, for example, performing outside. There are different considerations, right? What does it mean to perhaps have been a modern dancer that was in the studio with Marley and is now dancing outside for the first time? There are risks for injury that exist there that might not be able to be mitigated.
One way to address or examine some of these issues was the series that you launched on Facebook, which wraps up this coming week. What did you set as some of the goals of this weekly check-in and conversation?
So we have a weekly Facebook Live series titled Artists Are Necessary Workers. And really the trigger for that campaign was both an advocacy campaign, but also an opportunity for us to come together and look at the different needs of the sector and ensure that we were beginning to address what the future was going to entail. But the advocacy piece was really in response to ensuring that our city officials and the different leadership in our particular geography in New York City was recognizing that the work of artists is necessary in this time. And it was really in response to the severe budget cuts that were proposed during the budgeting negotiations for the city that were removing such a high number of funds from the Department of Education and from the Department of Cultural Affairs. The advocacy did result in a substantive amount of preservation of the budget for the Department of Cultural Affairs, but the Department of Education, which is a huge component of how artists work, experienced some very serious budgetary cuts in the area of the arts. And so for us, it was like hearing our city officials tell a story of the arts as merely the cherry on top of our cultural and civic life, as opposed to being deeply needed and necessary for the reimagining of what our world is going to be like after the pandemic and what is it going to mean to reengage in economic activity. During the series, what's been really great to witness is how we've been able to highlight different parts of the dance ecosystem, really understanding, for example, the innovation that has existed for decades within the disability dance community, for example, and how disabled dance artists have for decades existed in these digital platforms and have had to, in many ways, engage with some of the things we're having to do now during quarantine. And I say we in terms of non-disabled folks. And so we had an opportunity to highlight some of those learnings and the fact that disabled artists and activists have been putting to the test a lot of the things that now we've been using and now have become regular practice for us in a life of quarantine. Similarly, we were able to speak about the nature of our festivals, of the nature of our touring, all of the different aspects of the sector, and really dig into, okay, we are a creative workforce and we're having to make significant adjustments to how we are working. But really what this moment has afforded us is the opportunity to also examine the things that were not working before COVID, the parts of our ecosystem that were not healthy, that were not thriving, and how this pause presents both a lot of pain, but also the opportunity to reimagine what's going to come next so that we don't go back to some of those systems that were already not working.
Well, one of the other themes that has come up, certainly across the arts in general, is reflective of that in terms of diversity, inclusion. What are some of the specific ways that Dance USA has committed itself in the past, and what are some of the ways that you've looked at and had the chance to examine in this new environment?
For clarification, we are Dance NYC, and we do work in collaboration with Dance USA. Absolutely. We are dance partners. We are actually collaborating organizations, and so often the work that Dance NYC does and the learning that Dance USA does, we share a lot of that learning and are looking constantly for ways to replicate and really expand the work that we each do in different geographies. But to very forwardly answer your question, the reality of this moment for the dance community in New York City is very much recognizing that we're experiencing what folks are calling a double pandemic, right? We have COVID-19, and then we have the reality of structural racism and how white supremacy has manifested itself across all of the aspects of cultural and civic life in, across the country, but also within our sector. And so the things that have really surfaced about this moment, you know, Dance NYC has been working to address racial justice, disability rights, and immigrant rights for the past few years through a variety of our programs. But what this moment has really surfaced is beyond looking at outward-facing programming, right, beyond saying, okay, well, we're going to have a talk about this, or we might commission one Black dance company or one disabled dance company to say that we are engaged in conversation. What this moment has done, it has turned us to look inward, to really look at what are the infrastructures of how we are making work that are continuing to uphold these systems of oppression, and how do we begin to interrupt and intervene both within the individual dance maker's work, but also within the institutions. And so some of the things that have surfaced, for example, are pay equity, right? How is the issue around pay equity within dance a reflection of addressing inequity, right? How can we tackle the fact that dance workers aren't making living wages? Why is that a thing that we've accepted? How is it that within large dance-making institutions, we've been okay with mostly homogenous, racially homogenous, or gender-based homogenous workforces? How are we informing whose work is seen as beautiful and valuable, and how are we writing and speaking about that work? And how are we appropriately naming the legacies of the artistic works that we're experiencing, or the aesthetics that we are highlighting as meaningful and worthy to be funded? And then specifically, how are we then allocating resources? How are we ensuring that the resources that we have as a community are actually given and available to a workforce that is a reflection of the city that we serve, as opposed to a very small and specific portion of our community? So those are some of the things that have really surfaced, and most definitely a resurgence of support for the Black Lives Matter movement in recognizing that there are historic inequities that disproportionately impact Black, Indigenous, peoples of color working within the dance field, and disabled and immigrant workers as well.
Well, you mentioned that part of the series, or the advocacy goals of the series, was to demonstrate the need and the fact that, as you say, artists are necessary workers. Have you gotten any feedback from either officials or other people who are in those places that you were hoping to hear, that they're starting to get the message and that hopefully things will start being included?
Well, one of the first things that I have to say was we, as a community, not just within dance, but also across the performing arts, really came together to advocate, at least in New York City, for the upcoming budget year, right? The fiscal year 2021 budget was released. And one of the biggest victories that was certainly accomplished and named and recognized by our city officials was the most of the Department of Cultural Affairs budget was preserved, which was something that we did not expect. We actually expected a much more severe cut. And so that felt like a significant success for our community in terms of our city recognizing that even in a moment of national and local crisis, we needed to ensure that the agency that was responsible for culture was protected. So that was very meaningful. Dance NYC, along with many other cultural organizations, have actually had the opportunity to meet, for example, with the Commissioner of the Department of Cultural Affairs, Gonzalo Casals, who actually will be joining us for our closing event this week. We've had the opportunity to also connect with the mayor's office, as well as the city's marketing arm, New York City and Company. And so we have certainly seen a response from city officials, particularly in recognizing that dance is an important component of the arts, culture, and tourism sector of the city. And overall, a recognition that artists need to be engaged. We do feel like there is still plenty of work to be done. The severe cuts to the Department of Education budget in arts specifically, there was a 70% cut to the arts budget within the Department of Cultural, the Department of Education. That's an area that still is where we are advocating. And I think that part of the tension that's being managed here is the relationship that folks might have to the arts or to dance that is along the lines of the ticket for the show when we do the things that are fun that feel a little bit like they're not needed in a moment of pandemic. And how do we hold the tension of that being one of the things that we do with the other aspect of what we're doing now, which is dance educators helping parents through Zoom, right? It's the classes that are helping seniors, even in their senior homes right now during quarantine, remain active and connected to community. The many dance artists and activists that are helping to mobilize their local communities, the different arts organizations that are serving as food pantries that are helping to disseminate information, et cetera. And so all of the latter aspect of our work is often in the shadows. And so how do we highlight for our city officials and the philanthropic community that artists are both provide an opportunity for joy and for pleasure through performances, but really it's all of the work that happens out of the stage that is the most important role that we have in our local communities. The philanthropic community has been very responsive to supporting arts workers. Dance NYC has received a lot of support in the form of funds for regranting, and we've been able to support organizations and individuals in this time. But really, the question is, what's going to happen in the next year, in the next 2 years, and how can we ensure that these groups don't disappear if this crisis persists?
And as you mentioned, the final in the series is coming up this Tuesday. Who are some of the other guests that you're going to have, and how do you plan to bring these things together full circle?
So the last event in the series is titled Dance as Dignified Labor. And it's an important way to both end and begin the next focus of Dance NYC's advocacy work. We will have some wonderful speakers, Cliff Matias of the Red Hawk Native American Arts Council, Corny J. Cook of Urban Bushwoman, and she's really a performer and organizer that works across multiple groups in dance. Georgina Pascoe-Gwynn, who is a New York City Ballet soloist, and Sheila Lewandowski, who is the executive director of the Chocolate Factory Theater. So we have an interesting combination of folks working across different mediums, different genres of dance, working in different roles of dance. And the goal really for this conversation is, how do we get to this piece of dance work, the work of developing dance, of studying dance, of teaching dance? How can we, as a community, redefine the value of that and organize to ensure that the value of that then results in structures that allow for living wages to be paid to our workers? And so really closing off the series with more of a provocation for what's next, with more of a provocation for where as a field we need to go, and to begin to address a workforce resiliency that moves beyond the crisis response of COVID.
As we're all trying to get a sense of, you know, where the next few months will go, I guess now that the reality has set in that, okay, it wasn't 2 months, it wasn't 3 months, this is still going on. What are some of the challenges that you see coming up as this becomes such a prolonged issue?
Well, the biggest long-term issue that we're facing is people are losing their ability to pay for their basic needs: rent, food, healthcare. And those three things are three things that within the dance community and the arts community we can support ourselves with. But they are three things that also require legislation at every level of government: city, state, and federal. A lot of the dance-making entities that have venues are facing the same predicament that individuals that cannot pay rent are facing. And it's a question of which of the members of our community through time have had access to resources and the ability to save or develop cash reserves. And quite honestly, the lion's share of our community, and Dance NYC's data on the workforce has shown this through time, the lion's share of the community are actually very small budget groups, folks that are working with budgets under $1 million, and the majority of which are working with budgets under $250,000 a year. Hmm. And so we're talking about very small groups that have huge impact and that don't have the kind of financial flexibility to not have any kind of income over multiple months. And so the big question now is, how are people going to keep roofs over their heads, both institutions and individuals? How are people going to eat? And how are we going to be able to be prepared for what reopening entails, which essentially will come with additional costs? And so the big question that comes with this for us is, will we see the disappearance of the smaller culturally specific groups, the smaller hyper-local groups that were significant members of their community, because there's an absence of infrastructure that creates that support? The philanthropic community will not be able to really cover all of the losses that we've experienced. And individual donors or local community members that maybe in the past were a significant source of support for groups can no longer do that. And so this moment is requiring us as a community, both within dance and across the arts, to really come together in our advocacy efforts to ensure that we help to push our officials to craft legislation that actually is responsive to the needs of this moment for our community. Dance will not go away. Even in the midst of a moment of crisis, even as we are having to consider the structures in which we make work, and even as we are determining how, as a community, we can survive, dance and artistry and the work that artists do will continue to be necessary for both our community and the communities that we are a part of. And so we are certain that, much like the marquee of the Joyce Theater says, that we will dance again.
That was Alejandra Duque Cifuentes, Executive Director of Dance NYC. You can find a link to the upcoming panel discussion and past conversations at dance.nyc. I hope you enjoy the conversations I bring you each week on Atempo about the changes and challenges facing the performing arts. But remember that programs like this are made possible only through your support of this station. To become a member of the Classical Network, go to wwfm.org and click on Donate. Thank you for your support. Thank you for listening to Atempo. I'm your host and producer, Rachel Katz. You can listen to previous shows anytime in our webcast archive at wwfm.org. Join me next week for another look at the news and insight into some of the challenges and trends in the world of the performing arts. Atempo is a production of the Classical Network and is made possible in part by a grant from the Frank and Lilia Bergen Foundation and the support of our listener members.